So when you look at our current Western culture, in which lines of development are we clearly weaker than in former societies?
One of the real problems with any developmental sequence, let's just kind of go back to individuals for just a second to show what's involved. We can stick with Carol Gilligan's three general waves of moral development. We've been using that. You can make the case stronger with some other models, Jane Lovinger's, but this is straightforward and easy enough. One of the things you find with any developmental sequence is, like any stage of growth, from an egg to a chicken, something can go wrong at every stage. Every stage can have a disease, an illness, something can screw up on it, and so on. So atoms, for example, don't get cancer. Dogs get cancer because the more things that can go wrong, the more complex the system is. So in the developmental sequence from selfish to care to universal care, there's a pathology at each of those. There's a way that stage goes sour. Now, what that means is that the good news, if you're at universal care, is that, you know, you've gone through these three levels or stages. That's right. The bad news is there are three ways to get sick at that level, as opposed to the first stage, there's only one way to get sick. So if you sort of translate that back to the primal tribes of 500,000 years ago, if they were, let's say, at stage one in one of these lines, there's only one way to kind of screw that up. They seem relatively healthy in a certain sense. Whereas you can take modern societies, there are four and five and six levels of growth in those things, and there are six ways to be sick, all stacked on top of each other, and we've got all of them. So the incorrect conclusion is, therefore, modernity itself is completely sick. That's a really not very good way to read that information. But the correct way to read it is, oh, well, by the way, but we are really sick in ways that original tribes couldn't even imagine, literally. So that's part of the problem when we look at modern societies, is that things are going wrong at every level of development in so many ways, and the sum total of that wrongness is just spooky. So again, it doesn't give you any ultimate answers, but you can go in and look at this thing with a little bit more granularity and get a sense about what's happening. We have a couple of scales, and it differs from culture to culture. This culture notoriously has a bit of a kind of social alienation that tends to be higher than other cultures. We have such an extreme emphasis on individuality that we also have extremely high rates of a feeling of alienation, meaninglessness. Because there's that kind of fracturedness that tends to go with the higher degree of freedom that we try to offer, then a lot of groups get segmented, alienated, marginalized in the correct sense. One out of three young black males in the prison correctional system. We have more prisons than any culture in the world, possible exception of the previous Soviet Union. And all of those are not very healthy things. On the other hand, you can look at other scales, and we're really very, very highly developed. So it's just a matter, in that case, of almost going through with the scorecard and mentioning some of the things that are positive. Certainly technological development's very, very positive. Educational system for a very long time was positive. We've a little bit of a mess the last couple of decades, mostly because academia itself is becoming less integral for strange reasons.
I mean, you can say technological development's advanced, but then you could also say that it's partially responsible for the environmental destruction or some of the alienation.
In the hands of lower levels of moral development, high technological development is a disaster. It's a nightmare. But if you're at Gilligan's stage of universal care, the definition of that stage is you care for all sentient beings. I mean, that you don't get to be called that stage unless you evidence that. So if you're at that stage, and incidentally, not very many people are. A lot of these higher stages, less than 3 or 4 or 5% of the population is actually at some of these higher stages, a little bit scary. But if you're at that stage of universal care and you're given some of these technological innovations, you're going to use them to benefit the common good. That's the definition of that stage. If you're not doing that, you're not at that stage. The problem is that with technological development, somebody can, very, very smart in the cognitive line, can make a computer. But any idiot can use it. I know, because I use a computer. So that's the problem with technological development. It has sort of out there. So anybody at moral stage one can get their hands on an Uzi or a gas chamber or an atomic bomb and so on. So most of the environmental degradation that occurs from industrialization occurs because people are at the selfish stage of development and use it for selfish reasons. And then it's a nightmare because it's much stronger than a bow and arrow, much stronger than a hoe, much stronger than a plow. So of course you can do devastating environmental damage, but that doesn't mean that the culture's, you know, itself is in all ways lower than earlier. It's higher in some ways, but still a very low level of moral development for people that are getting their hands on it. if that makes sense.
Yeah, in fact, this has been very helpful to me because I think one of the questions I had was, you know, so if we're evolving, will Ken's theories look like dust if the world goes up in a nuclear disaster? I mean, it's going to really make his theories look idiotic.
Exactly.
Because he's talking about this whole
directionality
of development, but this doesn't make sense. But what you're saying, if I've got it right, is that we have to understand the lines of development in the collective sphere in the same way we have to understand it in the individual sphere.
Exactly. And they develop relatively independently. And the other thing to keep in mind is that a lot of people get confused about this, and certainly the early developmentalists did. Even if most people in society, in a given society, were at Gilligan's universal stage of development, everybody's still born at square one. Everybody's still born at the bottom of that scale, and they have to go through stage one first, then stage two, then stage three. Atoms, molecules, cells. You can't skip stages. You can't get around them. They're the ingredients of the higher stages. So even if we have a culture that has this ideal, you know, the superconscious state in all 24 lines, everybody's still born at square one in every single one of them. And some can go wrong at every one of those stages. And even the higher stages, the Darth Vader move is always possible. I mean, so the difficulty is as sort of evolution increases at large, really the more number of catastrophes that increase, you know, increases in certain ways. But that we can't draw the wrong conclusion from that, which is that we're, you know, we started out in paradise and we've gone downhill ever since. That's really, really a bad interpretation of that data. It doesn't hold up very well. But what we can do by looking at these different lines of development, we can see where we've advanced and where we haven't advanced, but also realizing that everybody's still born at square one. And that even if we have these higher stages as ideals and we try to educate people, help them fulfill their highest potential, some people aren't going to do it, and that's fine. There's no law against being at stage one, moral development. There is a law against acting on it, though, because our laws come from stage three, moral development. But even though it's up there, that doesn't guarantee people are going to get there, and cultures become this real amalgam of people at different levels, waves, and so on. And that's certainly true for cultures themselves. So again, no pat answers, but we can look much more clearly at what's going on and get a sense about where there's a strong development, where there's still really weak development or even pathological development, and try to sort of balance out that growth and development for a common good, basically.
But when you talk about the individual, you talk about there being a center of gravity.
Right.
So even though there are all these different lines, there's still a center of gravity that the person can be at in a stage conception.
Right.
Does that also apply to cultures?
What happens there is if you back up far enough, then you end up seeing what a lot of researchers, Gene Gepser, the most famous that we mentioned, would call epochs or great ages of human development. And if you back up that far, then it has a certain meaning. But it's a very far backup. I mean, you really, you know, it's thousands of years generally. So the generalized conception is archaic, magic, mythic, rational, integral. And the archaic age lasted, you know, 500,000 years up to about 50,000 years for humans. And then magical kicked in. Magical was from about 50,000 up to about 10,000 BC. And then mythic started kicking in. And that lasted up to the sort of modern era where rational kicked in. And now to this era where integral is starting to kick in. But at any of those epochs, people can be at any number of levels and lines. Cultures can be at sort of any number. And so it's useful in a very broad, broad sense. But when you get right down to it, it's not a good barometer of, let's say, how much trouble you're going to run into. Because the trouble increases as the levels of development increase. Because you can really, again, you know, original tribes didn't have atomic bombs. If they did, many of them would have used them. And, you know, that would have been the end of it. So the actual barometer you're using, it's very, very, very difficult to simply come up with a sort of center of gravity concept that has a lot of meaning in a narrow time sphere like this decade, let's say. Because it's like the stock market. On the overall, it goes up, but that you can still be in the Great Depression for 4 years. So it doesn't really have a lot of meaning on small scales. And even though it's demonstrably true that the center of gravity goes up over the long haul, sort of like the stock market, at any given century, you could be much worse off than you were centuries before. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
I'm interested in this whole idea of, you know, getting into trouble as you go up the stages. So evolution is a dangerous affair.
Yeah. Yeah, increases both the number of positives, the number of beneficial things you have, and it increases the number of diseases, increases the number of pathologies, the number of things that can go wrong, even in an individual. We talk about cognitive development being necessary but not sufficient for moral development. The people that were scary were these incredibly intelligent people that had low morals. That only happens with incredibly highly developed intelligence. It's not going to happen if we're, you know, humans are just coming out of great apes and our cognitive capacity is the equivalent of, you know, kindergarten. Then you're not going to get an Adolf Hitler or even a Genghis Khan. I mean, just there's not enough material to be that wicked. But you get a really super smart person in the modern era, get their hands on modern technology, and they have moral stage one, and you really got trouble. Jack the Ripper, you know, there seems to be this enormous kind of interest in Jack the Ripper in the last, probably because he was the first serial murderer, and people still can't quite figure out really who did it with any sort of compelling three or four sort of major candidates. But in what everybody agrees is one of the authentic letters that the Ripper sent to the police at the time, he said, "Men will look back and say that I gave birth to the 20th century." Now that's a real, that's, you know, he deserves to go into the history books for that for a very, you know, warped reason. But it's very true in a certain sense, because the 20th century was that kind of deliberate, cold-blooded serial murder that, frankly, original tribes just weren't capable of, and in a bizarre way. So you do drive-by shootings when you're a tribe. You still do drive-by shootings if you're a clan in today's inner-city ghettos. But deliberate, thought-out, cold-blooded serial murder, such as would end up in the Gulag Archipelago or in Dachau and Treblinka, that's a very high cognitive development coupled with a very, very crude moral development. And you just don't get that in a sense. You know, only with the higher levels of development can that kind of disease kick in. And that can happen in individuals. I was just saying that, you know, mad scientists, very, very high cognitive development, not so hot on the other lines. But what you can't say, though, is you can't then condemn evolution itself, because what we're talking about here is uneven evolution. So somebody who has a high cognitive development and has an equally high moral development, then they're at the universal care stage. And they're not going to do those other things. If they are, they're regressing or they're falling out of that stance. So evolution, in a sense, is a good thing. But it's just not even, and it doesn't happen that way. And there are all these various things going on, and everybody's still born at square one and has to go through the whole process. And in that sense, there's just more and more things that can go wrong. And all this uneven development can occur. But that doesn't mean that evolution itself is actually devolution or going downhill or something like that.
What would you say to the people who, because they're so upset with what they see around them in terms of environmental disaster right. and warfare, that say, you know, it's hard for me to agree with you that there is this overall evolutionary trajectory happening.
Right.
Certainly when I've talked to some people about your work, that's one of the criticisms that I hear.
Yeah. Well, again, I think that comes from just looking at some of these developmental lines that have been really pathological or shown uneven development and really forgetting all the other areas that really even allow these people to make the criticisms. Increased longevity, for example. A lot of people say, well, do you know what we'd be doing now if we were in the original tribes? And we go, yeah, you'd be dead, because the average lifespan was 18 years. I mean, you're 45 years old, and that's a product of modern development, as is the lack of slavery, as is extraordinary medical benefits and so on. And then the downsides are equally horrifying. But you have to kind of be fair in your scorecard, in a sense. And what usually happens is it's very easy, the original Enlightenment folks, Western Enlightenment, to call the positives and ignore the negatives. And now it's just as common to see people take all the negatives and ignore all the positives. And I think that's just as not integral, that's just as unbalanced as the other side. So it's, and Habermas, the philosopher we talked about, actually has a phrase called the dialectic of progress, which means good news, bad news. And that's at least, the good news, bad news is a much more balanced, I think, kind of approach than merely seeing the bad news everywhere. Environmental degradation is clearly the main problem, I think, in terms of all the overall problems. Follow very closely by what terrorist activity could do, or just the continuing human warfare, whoever instigates it. And certain types of sort of interpersonal unfairness as well. And we can argue about capitalism and its sort of ruthless disregard of feelings and so on. But even on the ecological crisis, if you look at that, I mean, Gaia's not going anywhere. I mean, if we really mess up the environment, what it means is we'll probably kill ourselves and scrape off, you know, 25% of the species on the planet. But we're not going to get rid of the biosphere entirely. We're not going to get rid of Gaia entirely. And that's, you know, I mean, it's not good news. But the Earth will do fine. It's, you know, we're the ones that are leaving. On the other hand, we might get to a point where it will become so bad that we'll be forced to deal with it. Whether that'll happen or not, who knows? But I don't see any previous period in history where people had a chance to use this technology and said, no, let's don't use it because it would hurt the environment. Most of the so-called ecological wisdom in previous ages were due to lack of means, not presence of wisdom. And most of the early tribes are slash and burn agriculturists. I mean, these were not people that radically had a post-conventional global view of the common good. So that has never really existed, in my opinion, anywhere on a widespread scale. We have yet to develop that. Now, we may or may not do it. But I don't think there was a point in the past where we had that and that that's been lost. What we simply did have is an incapacity to inflict this kind of damage that we're now inflicting catastrophically. And we will either get it or we will be gone. But I think it's still, you can't score us out on that scale until we're gone. That's the final scorecard on that. And I actually think that if you actually look at the types of strides that have been made in environmental protection, it's relatively impressive. Obviously, it's still a nightmare out there. But the types of world, I mean, even the Kyoto Accords is something, that, except the dim-witted United States, there's a kind of a global consensus emerging about what we have to do to live in accord with nature. That's never happened before. That's really astonishing, actually. Is it in time? I don't know. It's looked very, very spooky in terms of the degradation that's already going on. But I can't read something like the Kyoto Accords, which is historical first, where you have a cross-cultural agreement on a response to nature. That's a staggering historical achievement. I can't read that. It's just bad news.
So is it fair to say that in the collective sphere, you think that we are glacially evolving and incurring more dangers as a result, but that we are, in fact, moving in that direction, positive evolutionary direction?
Yeah. Glacially is the operative word, and that brings on a capacity for increased danger, increased types of diseases, and increased pathologies, but also increased potentials. And the potentials are also, I think, really important, because we're also getting to a point where higher states and stages of consciousness are also becoming kind of better known, more accepted in certain ways. People are reporting these kinds of experiences. You have sages like Aurobindo talking about the evolutionary unfolding of spirituality. Everybody's pretty familiar with Teilhard de Chardin. That's one part of the story. And you can't misread it. It's just sweetness and light because all these other bad things are happening. But it's still part of the story. It's in a great part of the story.
Which leads me, do you think that there are more enlightened people or more higher evolved people alive now than in past eras?
Yeah, and that's another one of those. That's a very difficult scorecard to judge. And one of the things, though, that you have to kind of keep in mind is, I've asked a couple of Zen masters how many enlightened Zen masters they thought there were now and how many really great Zen masters were, you know, in all of history. And it's usually not a really large number. Maybe 100 really great Zen masters is a kind of common answer, maybe 1,000 sort of. But if you look at...
Alive today or throughout history?
It's throughout history.
Throughout history?
Yeah.
That's not very many.
Exactly. And even if you sort of bump it up to 10,000 or something, that came out of China, which is, you know, a gazillion number of people. So if you take the percentage of human beings that were enlightened at that period, it's just minuscule. But a lot of us, I know, when I first studied, I practiced Zen for a long time among other practices. And when I first started doing it, I thought, God, China, you know, all these great Zen masters. I mean, everybody was enlightened and everybody was doing this and it was so wonderful. And just really a minuscule handful of them. I know a lot of people start studying shamanic studies and they get the sort of feeling that like every person in every tribe was a shaman, you know, 50,000 years ago. Of course, there was one shaman per tribe, if you're lucky, and maybe 1 out of 10 of them were good. So, I mean, these are very, very small percentages. In the past, we tend to idealize that. Everybody in Egypt was doing kundalini, you know, because they had the serpent power on their head and stuff. And God, it probably weren't more than 100 that were really, really accomplished in that stuff. At the same time, there are cultures like the Tibetan where you certainly have a higher percentage. My own sense is that what is increasing is the degrees of freedom in societies that allow you to pursue these endeavors. So even in a Tibetan culture, for example, as deep as their realization was in certain ways, it was also narrow. I mean, there was no room for other cultures in a Tibetan culture. That's just sort of how it works. But in today's United States, for example, you can be a Hindu, a Buddhist, Jewish, Taoist, you know, those degrees of freedom are increasing. And I think that's very positive. I think that's going to continue to increase, incidentally, because I think certain of these stages of development are slowly, glacially nudging up. And as that happens, larger percentages of people get moved into these higher practices. And I think that will happen. But that, again, is something you can actually sort of go out and do the best you can to score it, so to speak. But I certainly don't think it's a downhill slide. I think that tends to come from idealizing yesterday.